This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Considered America's pastor, Billy Graham died yesterday at the age of 99. In the late 40s, his crusades filled tents, and his showmanship quickly evolved into what would be televangelism.
When Sir Walter Raleigh had laid his head upon the executioner's block, and the officer asked if his head lay right, Sir Walter Raleigh said, "It matters little, my friend, how the head lies, provided the heart is right." The heart has come to stand for the center of the moral, spiritual, and intellectual life of a man. It's the seat of a man's conscience and life. And the question that I want to ask you tonight is this: is your heart right?
Evangelist Billy Graham speaking in 1957. Joining us now to talk about the legacy of Billy Graham is Grant Wacker, a professor emeritus of Christian history at Duke Divinity School and the author of America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Grant Wacker, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about the appeal of Billy Graham in those years in his prime and gathering those audiences as he did. What was he tapping into?
Part of it was his own personality, as we heard on that clip. He's a dynamic preacher, and he brought people in, and people were taken in, impressed by his sincerity, his articulateness, forcefulness. So part of it was him himself, but it was also his message, and it was a message of a second chance. No matter how much you've messed up your life, and most of us have, he proclaimed, there is a second chance in Christ. And I think that was the very heart of the message. And that wasn't limited to Christians, let alone evangelical Christians. I mean, everybody's messed up. And yeah. So he had this message of a second chance for everyone.
And as you point out in your book, that's a kind of quintessentially American message, the forward-looking possibilities of improving your situation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you look at all the major political movements of the 20th century, the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the compassionate conservatism and so forth, no matter what one thinks of it, the Make America Great Again. In all of these great political movements are all together. I mean, again, all of these movements go by this sense of something new. Or Franklin Roosevelt's theme song, "Happy Days Are Here Again." Mm. So Graham tapped into that sense of hope and possibility, which is very American. Yeah.
We think of him as the quintessential televangelist. That is a field that has certainly been sullied since his appearance on the scene with others who have fallen from grace. Where does he stand in that, and what's his role in sort of propelling a movement that, as I say, ended with people who he didn't even think fondly of?
Right. Let's take that in two parts. First, the last, not thinking fondly of. He distanced himself from the Christian right. He said that Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson are my friends. He said, I agree with parts of their theology. But he said, number one, they don't talk enough about poverty and homelessness. So Graham himself was basically a moderate Republican, but he felt that the Christian right had just missed out on its message. The larger problem with the Christian right, though, is he said they bring politics in the pulpit, and the pulpit is a site for a higher gospel that transcends politics. So that was his resistance to the Christian right, and part of the reason that he wouldn't follow them on television or anywhere else. Despite tremendous entreaties from them. Now, as for television, it's important to remember that actually he rose to fame on radio. He started radio coast to coast in 1950. And here he drew on a long tradition of religious radio, but within weeks, his Hour of Decision, as it was called, was the most heard religious radio program in the nation, and it remained that way for some 20 years. So the first step was radio, and then he moved into television. But very, I think it's very interesting that he was also an entrepreneur, and he knew what worked and what didn't, and he did not want to saturate the market with himself. And so very quickly after they started, they moved away from weekly broadcasts into quarterly broadcasts. Overexposure
was something
was one of his worries. Yeah,
you talked about his being worried too about or concerned that the Christian right had been bringing politics to the pulpit. He was someone who was counselor to the president, and I guess where his reputation suffered the most was with his close relationship with Richard Nixon.
Absolutely, I'd say every time that Graham, from a historical standpoint, every time he got into trouble, and that every time that he did something that historians look back with a raised eyebrow or more, it almost always related back to Richard Nixon. And this is, and Frank, this is a very strange relationship. How he was drawn into Nixon's charisma is difficult to explain, but he was. But on the other hand, the whole nation was. I mean, you know, Nixon won the 72 election by the greatest margin of any presidential candidate in history. So he certainly wasn't alone. Nixon won every state except Massachusetts and District of Columbia. So Graham was part, but he was more than that. He played golf with Richard Nixon more than 100 times. And Nixon called him asking for his advice. And we have transcripts of this. So there was a strange chemistry between them. It went too far.
And most infamously, I guess, when he gave succor to and actually contributed to Nixon's own anti-Semitism.
Absolutely. And that was in 1972. And when the tape was exposed 30 years later in 2002, he was, Graham was mortified. And at first he wouldn't respond to it because he thought it was a hoax. But after, I think, 3 days, he became convinced that it was him himself, and he was mortified. He said, "The things I said that day did not represent the things I thought then. They certainly don't represent what I think now." And his only excuse, and that's all it was an excuse, but, and he admitted that, he said, "The only thing I can say is that when you're in the office, the Oval Office, and you're," this wasn't his word, but he says, "basically, and you're schmoozing with the President of the United States, it's very hard to stop and say, no, Mr. President, you're wrong." Because, and it was a private conversation. Yeah. And, you know, these are guys who play golf together all the time. So, but he regretted it bitterly. And he said, "I learned a lesson, and I've tried to stay out of partisan politics." Now, Frank, he fell off the wagon. He couldn't stay out, but he tried anyway.
Yeah, and it, well, another deep regret that he expressed was not being more vocal about the civil rights movement.
Yeah, although I would have to qualify and say I think that on the whole he was proud of what he did do, and what he did do was integrate his crusade starting in 1953 or even 52. He made steps in 52 in 53. He decisively integrated, and he said, "There will never again be separated seating in my crusades." That's a year before Brown versus Education. Now, he saw that as his major contribution, and he took an enormous amount of criticism. And in fact, the organization has a whole folder of death threats to him and his family. And part of that was because of his stand on integration. And I read a lot of the letters that were sent to Graham, and not a few of them charged him with communist sympathies. So it took courage. I certainly have to say it took courage to do what he did.
You visited him several times in his home in North Carolina, and again toward the end of his life. How is he looking forward to death?
He said, my wife always went with me, and he was a southern gentleman to the end, and he was far more interested in her than he was in me. You know, he struggled to rise and shake hands with her first, and so the conversation was with her, and they talked about death, and one bit of the conversation I remember is that he said, I've always been prepared to die. He said, "I have not been prepared to get old." stopped us.
How do you think he will be remembered? Again, a long and a tumultuous career, much controversy toward the middle and end. How is he going to be remembered, do you think?
I think it'll be positive. I think that the mistakes he made, which are real, I mean, and he admitted he made some real mistakes, including even trivial ones. He once criticized himself for watching television too much. I have no idea when he could have done that, but anyway, you know, that was his self-perception. Yeah. So he was self-critical. He apologized for many things, and I think that historians will recognize and appreciate his own realism about himself. Now, at the same time, he understood his own accomplishments. I mean, Billy Graham knew he was Billy Graham, but he's also a humble man, and it was that combination that we saw in visiting him that it's intriguing, where a man is deeply humble about his personal himself, who he is, but he's also accepting of his accomplishments. And, you know, with us, he never once said, "Aw, shucks, I didn't really do anything." He knew he had done major things, but then he instantly said, "But it isn't me. You know, this is all a gift that came from God, and I just tried to use my gifts."
Grant Wacker is a professor emeritus of Christian history at Duke Divinity School and the author of America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation. Grant Wacker, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, what beliefs do some religions share in common? We'll talk about the perennial wisdom on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.